You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, you're listening to Invisible, The Stranger's weekly conversation with people in art. I'm Jen Graves, and I'm here with Wade Cavanaugh.
Hi.
We're at Tsuyama Space, where your installation called...
Regrade.
Just opened yesterday. And it is a... Well, it's a little hard to describe, but it's 10,000 hand-formed sheetrock bricks. So yeah. Essentially these sort of, they look like wafers, but I imagine they're a lot heavier, that form a kind of rolling terrain in the room, filling it up, that sort of mimics the landmass that was here before the regrade, before the Denny regrade. How did you get here? How did you first know about Tsuyama Space? You were living in Brooklyn with a studio in Maine. How did you first
Good friend of mine, John Bisbee, is old friends with Beth Sellers.
Okay.
And Beth invited me out here to take a look and submit a proposal.
It sounds like it really suits your work, this project.
Yeah.
Because your work is based in architectural intervention.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, the space is perfect.
And talk about how you got from, you got to your proposal, because I imagine, getting to know the regrade and also the idea of putting the space in context.
Well, Beth was in Maine last fall giving a lecture at the school where I was teaching, and I had a great studio visit with her. And was talking to her about past projects that I'd done. And so she gave me the seed of the regrade as something that may be interesting to play off of.
Had you known about it before?
Uh-uh. No.
It's kind of crazy.
It's fascinating, yeah.
Yeah. So, obviously that's a sort of a historical influence, but what about art influences?
For this piece?
You're talking about Irwin.
Right.
He is like the biggest influence on young artists.
Really?
I think he is.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
On critics too. I mean, I'm really interested in him.
Yeah. So Robert Irwin, we were talking just briefly about the moment when he's in his studio and Lawrence Welschler's book, deciding whether to move a bar on his painting up or down by 1/16 of an inch over the course of 3 weeks. And
he's like agonizing over this.
Yeah, agonizing. And he realizes that the decisions that he's making are only valid in the context of his studio, and that the architecture is in his periphery is weighing heavily on the decisions that he's making in this object in front of him. And so his investigation leads him to get rid of the object and to start worrying about how to manipulate the full environment. That's what I imagine myself doing when I come to a new place. I imagine myself with an object and think about all the things that weigh on the viewer's perception of that object. By perception, I have a very kind of expansive view of that, like the not only the historical things, or not only the direct things in the architecture, but the historical things that led to that architecture, and then also the some of the future implications. Like perception is always predictive. It's like we only glean the information from our sensory barrage to get us to the next step, or to get us to we only store things that have meaning, or that we think will have meaning. So I try to play back and forth in that spectrum, and make an object that really activates the viewer's sense of the space, that involves them in that process.
Can you talk about why this material, why these building materials? It kind of, in the gallery now, it resembles rubble. But it also, you know, has to do with the accumulation work that you see in, like, Tara Donovan's work, or even Maya Lin was here a couple of years ago and did these huge landforms. And some of the most, I thought, effective pieces that, that she did were actually little landforms that you could walk between, sort of, you know. And in addition, you know, photography that deals with taking very small sort of pixels and like piling and piling and piling and piling and piling, dealing with excess, dealing with destruction. You know, these look like rubble from a distance. When you get a little closer, you start to see there are all these decisions that have actually been made, and especially color decisions that are kind of surprising, you know, and nice. But why did you choose this? I mean,
why sheetrock?
Yeah.
Well, first and foremost, like the sheetrock walls and the concrete walls form the phenomenological like context that the viewer is making sense of this work in. And so
the stuff of the building.
It's the stuff of the building, and so it those things are going to weigh heavily on the understanding of the piece, anyways. And so it seems to make sense to make work of those materials. And so the thing about the Denny Regrade, which was really kind of fascinating, is that there was this, R.H. Thompson had this ideological overlay to his planning, and that he was this thoroughbred wasp that hated the blue collar element of Seattle. And so
he was the engineer, the city engineer who pushed through the plan.
And so it was a physical wash of earth that went down into Elliott Bay, but it was also an ideological wash that essentially gentrified the neighborhood.
The idea was to create a business district.
For the economic, you know, well-being of the space. And in New York, whenever you see a pile of sheetrock out on the sidewalk, it means that someone's losing their home and that luxury lofts are going in. And so sheetrock, for me, has become emblematic of gentrification. But it also fundamentally, like, in this space, it it makes a lot of sense. Like,
It also has the benefit of these kind of the surfaces of it, where you have these, like, the way you've stacked them on their sides, and they look, you know, they have the rough edges of bricks.
They're all power washed.
Oh, they are? Okay. Because they look like, they look very rough and kind of old. But obviously, you know, you just made them.
I wanted them to look as old and as distressed as possible. And so, like, the invention of sheetrock is actually a really fascinating invention. Like, if you imagine these walls being made up of lath and then being plastered over, like, the skill involved with that and the time involved with that is, it's kind of mind-blowing to think about now. And to take a piece of paper and then to lay gypsum a half inch thick and then to sandwich in another piece of paper is just really smart. But I wanted to, again, getting back to this sense of time, like economic, something that, that reeks of economic time, but of a geologic proportion, like the Denny Regrade. I wanted to take this commodity, this these 4x8 sheets, or these scraps of sheetrock, and undo them, technologically undo them, to make bricks, and then to undo the bricks to make them into a landscape.
So when you did this, you bought, I assume, you know, sheetrock in sort of single width, and then
most of it's waste. Most of this piece is waste.
Is waste? Oh, okay. So you salvaged it, and then you stacked them on top of one another and joined them together.
Joined them together. And then shape them and then power wash them.
Okay. One of the things that strikes me about this piece, the longer I look at it, is the way that, you know, it's all the many pieces put together to form this kind of larger landscape. And of course, the kind of classic example of that in art history is Impressionism. And I see what to me looks a little like a kind of nod to the coloring that happens in Impressionism, sort of like the You know, I mean, this sounds really weird because this piece, this is the last thing you would think of when you look at this piece, but it, when you really start to see it, you know, the colors sort of pop out and then pop back in again, mm-hmm. Which is an effect that you see a lot. And when you're walking down the, down kind of the aisles between mm-hmm. these forms. So I wanted to ask what you, you know, were thinking about in terms of color and light in making this piece, or if you were, I mean, I'm seeing sort of pale yellow uh-huh. and purples, and there's some green, and there's also writing on them, like they're uh-huh. not particularly precious.
Uh-huh. The color is actually the most exciting and somewhat unintended part of this piece.
Huh.
And there are two different types of color happening here. There's one, the color of the gypsum mm-hmm. and the rock, mm-hmm. and the other is the color of the paper. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so those speak to two different things, which I think add to this piece. If I just bought all the sheetrock from one source, I would have had pretty much that gray New Brunswick gypsum, mm-hmm. which is what we get in the East. Mm-hmm. But because I picked from the waste at lumberyards, I got this range from gray to mm-hmm. white to pink.
Mm-hmm. And so, in the East and in the West, or where were you mostly?
Just in the East.
Just in the East.
I made them all in the East, but they mm-hmm. they the way they come, these, a lot of this stuff was the bedders that separate lifts of sheetrock, and they come kind of prefabbed, mm-hmm. and they're the waste from the factory.
Okay. That actually makes the sheetrock.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anytime you get a color difference here, it's a geographical distinction. And so like that white rock is like I think like mostly from like Pennsylvania or in the South.
Huh.
And what they're starting to do is to set up gypsum plants next to coal-fired power plants. So they'll take limestone and run it through the filters, and the slurry with whatever it is, CO2 or whatever is put off from the coal-fired power plant,
makes
that,
it white.
That chemical interaction makes gypsum, and so
they'll
take the byproduct and make sheetrock out of it because we're slowly exhausting our
right.
gypsum quarries. And then the really pink stuff is from the Southwest, and so you get this
Southwest of
the United States.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And what about the? That's really interesting that there are these sort of and. So the actual sort of stony parts mm-hmm. are what are giving you the geographical information. The paper is not.
The paper is more about its use as a commodity. And so, like the straight gray uh-huh. is just wallboard.
Uh huh.
The green is waterboard stuff that you put in your bathroom.
Uh huh.
And they all have different fire ratings. And so the, you know, the purples, the yellows, all of these things are. You know, different uses.
But more or less flammable, in other words?
Yeah, right.
Or, okay.
Yeah, fire,
mm-hmm.
the level of fire retardant. But what, you know, the choice to have these things in here, I think, is what you're probably after. Like, why this, you know, mm-hmm. instead of a myelin or a Terry Donovan landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I wanted to...
Yeah, those are indistinguishable
right,
parts.
Right,
mm-hmm.
I really wanted this to feel... to have some type of dystopian feel to it, as if, like the Denny Regrade, like it was the built environment mm-hmm. in a state of deterioration, mm-hmm. instead of an abstract interpretation of land, mm-hmm. you know, like Terry Donovan or like Myelin.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be there to be that variability, and like the writing is, you know, it's from past projects that I've done, like that wall piece, like all the scraps from that wall piece got made into bricks for this piece.
Oh, okay.
But like in mm-hmm. the process, like, you know, they have notes on them just as I was doing the making of the piece. And so hopefully that has that sense that it has been used before or, mm-hmm. you know, has a human element.
Two more questions about this piece. Mm-hmm. Is there an armature underneath? And does it represent an actual sort of very specific, you know, area of land that was actually right here on this spot, or no?
The armature question I'm not going to answer publicly.
You answered it. You answered
it
already.
Right, fine. There's an armature.
I represent a public ear.
Yeah, all right. So there is an armature.
Okay.
And second, I really have no interest in making a literal artwork.
Okay.
The Denny regrade is like, it happened. It's influenced everything else that has happened in Seattle, and that's my interest. I don't care.
Okay.
Beyond that.
The part of the reason I asked is that there was a work here not long ago that its title is slipping my mind now, but it was the actual latitude and longitude of the space.
Oh,
so
yeah,
it was
right.
Very specific.
Very specific. Yeah.
The second question I have is, what is going to happen to this when it's taken down? What's going to happen to all this? 10,000 bricks, right?
Yeah, it'll get packed back in the boxes, go back to Maine, and be reincorporated
to 15,000 square foot studio.
Yeah, that I share.
Incorporated into another piece.
Yeah,
I see.
It'll be
well,
another piece.
Speaking of the transition between one piece and another, you were, I would say, the victim of basically, you know, being ripped off by Anthropology, the clothing store. Can you tell me about that?
My friend Stephen Wynn and I do collaborative paper projects. And in 2005, we did a project in Portland, Maine that was
At the Map Room?
At the Map Room, which is Anna Hepler's gallery space. And the formerly it looked like these sedimentary layers made out of brown craft paper. And the images were published in Sculpture magazine that summer.
What summer was that?
I think it was like the July 2005 issue. And no, maybe it was 2006. I forget.
Okay. When was the show?
The show was 2005. And so the next thing we know, Stephen went to school in Victoria. And the next thing we know, we got a call from his friend saying, your piece, or I just saw your piece in Anthropology. Great job.
Downtown?
Yeah.
Seattle.
And we're like, what are you talking about? And then I had contact with Beth at that time and asked her to go check it out.
Beth Sellers, a curator here.
Yeah. And she was irate.
Yeah,
and,
the photographic evidence is crazy.
Yeah,
it's wild.
They're the same thing.
So they hadn't contacted you?
No.
Okay.
No.
And you did or didn't contact the lawyer? What happened?
We did, yeah. We had one of the best copyright lawyers in New York.
Jeff Kunzlayer.
Jeff Kunzlayer.
Right?
Yeah, John Cagle. And we had no rights, essentially, because the piece that we did was in a non-profit context.
Right. If it had been in a commercial space with a price tag on it,
then we'd be rich.
Then you would have just have been what?
Yeah.
You would have gotten the price of the piece, right?
Which is better than
or you could have won the price.
Now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's wild. Did you ever notify Anthropology?
They knew about it because their lawyers contacted them.
Really?
But that's one of the I actually want to go this afternoon. Like I want to actually go see the place and
yeah.
I don't know.
Is it still up?
No, it's not still
I
up.
I didn't think so. I remember seeing it though.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're going to go see the store?
Yeah.
Are you going to take it up with somebody?
I'm not. I'd like to. I forget the lady's name who actually, you know, did it. But it's funny. It's like that project Steve and I did, you know, maybe for $1,000. And we did it like, we were both working pretty much full time. So we would leave the city on the bus and work like 48 hours straight and go back and then come back. Like we'd go back and forth between Maine and New York. And then it's like they see the images, and they've got this huge production budget,
right?
And they hire seven people for
right.
2 weeks, and
right.
It's like
wow.
It's totally. I don't know. I don't know what the word is. It makes me really sour about commerce and advertising, and
yeah.
Especially when that's what we do now.
Right.
Yeah.
Well. Good luck with this.
Yeah. Thanks.
Don't let anyone publish any photos.
Yeah. Or at least, you know, for other people out there, like,
right.
Submit your images to the copyright,
office
before you publish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking all this time.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
It's been great.
You've been listening to Invisible. I'm Jen Graves. Thanks much.